something cool, different one. I bought this for the, we're going to do some live locations with the ball team.
Yeah.
So I was going to have two announcers.
Yeah.
And this will record just the ambience of the
crowd. Yeah, yeah.
So I have the whole thing right
there. The noise,
right.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. All right, so for the record, your name, first name and last.
My name is Randy Stonechild.
And which residential school did you attend?
I attended Gordon's Residential School in 1981 and Librette Qu'Appelle Indian Residential School about 1982, I guess.
Okay. Let's start with recollections from Gordon's school. What do you remember from that school? Things that stand out in your memory?
Well, I remember the first day going in and just the ominous look of the school, man. Like, it seemed very institutional to me. It was almost like going into, like, at that point I had experiences with some, like, partial experiences with places like, not Dojack, but Dale's House, being transferred between different social services institutions. On the way being moved back home because I'd been staying with. So it kind of reminded me of that. It was very ominous, I thought. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like scary, pretty scary, you know, okay. Going into it. And then getting in there, the whole thing was just, was exactly what I thought it would be like. There was a lot of student-to-student violence. It seemed like a lot of the staffers were cranky or angry or something, or just seemed like they didn't want to be there. And, you know, it kind of made me wonder, well, what the hell are you doing here as a child care worker? And it was kind of it was a pretty scary going into it. And it definitely some place that I didn't want to be in the first place, you know. But my mother, after my father, like, the reason why we had gone to residential school was we went there after my father passed away. My father passed away when I was 12, and my mother was a working woman. And we were, in essence, me and my little brother and my nephew, we were res boys, you know, and moving to the city after my, like, because we lived out here with my father.
So it was volunteer then, you were taken?
No, well, I wasn't taken.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
It was something that, it was, you know, and I didn't really want to go, but you know, with my mother away working, the way it was, us boys lived on the reserve with my father. My father farmed out here on the Okanis First Nation. My mother worked in the city.
What was your dad's name?
My father's name was Kenneth Stonechild.
Okay.
His father was Harry Stonechild, so, former chief. Mm-hmm. So we lived out here with my father. And the girls lived in the city with my mother, where my mother had worked as elder's helper, not a helper's helper, but she was a nurse's aide in a nursing home.
Sure.
A nurse's aide in a nursing home. So, and she got paid very well at that. But having nobody out here to look after me and my brother and my nephew, There we were kind of at a standstill.
Were your parents residential school?
Yes, yeah, both my mother and my father. My father actually attended the Okanis residential school here.
Okay.
And my mother had attended Librette Indian Residential. So we were, at that point, I was already second generation residential school.
So that first day walking in there, you kind of had a feeling of what you're expecting.
And yeah,
pretty
yeah.
Much that's what's how it was. You're mentioning how everybody was kind of, and it seemed like they were in a bad mood.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, at that time, was there the priests and the nuns, and then they had the CW workers?
No. At that time, I believe that Indian Affairs and the Gordon's First Nation already took over residential school, because at that time, already there was no... there was no priests or nuns. There was a priest there, but he was kind of like the school chaplain. But it was taken over at that time. It was the old William Starr. Like this, I mean, with all this residential school thing, this is kind of a... We, that attended that, those years at Gordon's Residential, we were the ones that kind of broke this all open. We were the very first complainants to file to file residential school claims. Before that, it was always spoken about and talked about, but it was never anything brought to any government. This, we were the ones, and it turns out that one of the guys that went to school there had been charged for a pedophilia, but it all came forward from the residential school and how he had been, and this is where it all broke open through criminal action. And, you know, it's like after that, you just heard it all over the place. And next thing you know, it started out in Gordon's, and it just kind of spread outwards in a ripple effect all across the country. These stories started coming up about stories in different residential schools all across the country, from east to west, north to south.
From the survivors I've talked to, it happened, but nobody said
anything. Yeah, it's exactly what it was. Anything. Yeah, it was commonly known, but yeah, never spoken of.
Yeah, you know, from what the inference I get is that they didn't want to tell their parents for fear of getting licking from their parents.
Yeah,
and they didn't want to say anything because if their parents got hung up, they might get the licking from the
yeah.
Police and stuff.
Yeah, and on top of that, they were dealing, you know, the old people were dealing with, you know, like it was a shame and a taboo that everybody knew about, but nobody spoke of it.
Right.
You know, it's like before that, you know, before, and everybody knew because, you know, there have been a lot of people that would sit and talk. And it was like, yeah, the residential school is old, you know. It's like, but no, they'd speak to one another, but not to anybody else in an official capacity. Before we students came forward at Gordon's Residential, a lot of this was known and talked about, but never brought to light. After we'd broken that open at residential school, because it was, you know, and I didn't hear anything about this until some of the students, the former students from residential school, I'd run into a few of them here and there, and, you know.
Did you keep up relations with any?
Oh, a lot of the boys that, and I wasn't friends with everybody, but I had enough friends out there that, and the ones that I did keep in contact with were really good friends, you know. It was like some of the guys that we went through a lot of crap with too, you know, and know that they went through it too, you know. It was like, but for myself, what I went through was the physical violence. You know, I'd suffered a damaged forearm and a dislocated shoulder at the hands of one of the child care workers. But the thing with my claim was, there was documents. There was documents at the hospital. There was documents from the ambulance, and even police came and took as well as social services. So, for me, when I filed my claim, they found all this stuff, and it was easy for me to get what I got for my residential. But a lot of them, the stuff was uncooperated and undocumented, and it was just word of mouth and hearsay. But the court system relied a lot of corroboration, other student corroboration. Oh, okay. For the stories. You know, it was like it was something tough to go through when I went for my discovery of hearing. I thought, oh, this, you know, let's go in and do this, you know. But when I sat there and I started telling the story, and I found myself kind of feeling like bringing back that anger, you know. And then, like, and then there was other things too, like, why the hell does somebody, you know, do that to a child? At that time, I was like 13 years old, you know. It's like being kicked and having my forearm broken and my shoulder dislocated, and then on top of that, when I couldn't get up, I got kicked in the ribs too. Hey, get the hell up! You're just, you know, you're not You quit faking it, you know. And when I couldn't, had a hard time getting up, I got kicked in the ribs for a day, you know. So it was, one of those things that it sticks with you. But I've been lucky, you know, like in the course of my younger brother and my nephew that attended the residential school with me, they got their settlements before me, and they got a whole lot more than me. And I seen these guys, and as well as other relatives that had gotten, I seen them, and it's like the large amounts of cash that they got, and I couldn't believe the time that it took them to spend it. It was like real fast, you know. It's like and a lot of them, it wound up hurting these people more than it did help, you know. I don't want to say it, but it has to be said, because a lot of instances and cases that residential settlement money did a lot more damage than it did good, you know.
Especially
people. Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of times too, a lot of these people have seen that yeah, money
yeah.
Time.
That's right, yeah. And for myself, when I seen all this, like I kind of took it upon myself. You know what? Well, that's not going to be me. I'm not. In the year and a half before my settlement was reached, I took to sending myself to treatment center. You know, get some help. I don't want to be like shit. My nephew wound up doing 3 years for possession of controlled substances, namely cocaine, you know, trying to be a baller sort of thing with all his cash. And another one wound up in jail for impaired charges, you know, and causing vehicle accidents and hurting people, you know, impaired driving, you know. And I was like, I'm not going to wind up like that, you know. I've always been one that kind of, well, you know, kind of look ahead before you figure on this right here. If I do this right now, what are the consequences down the line? You know, so it was, for me myself, it was a simple thing. And then all my children are still young yet. And it did me good, because, you know, getting sober in the time before, I was able to, with that clear thought and clear my presence of mind, I was able to prioritize and know what I wanted to do. And, you know, it's like, with my money lasted me quite a while. Like, I'm talking about 7 years, you know. That the amount of cash that I got lasted me a long time, and I was able to help a lot of people, you know. It's like, it's a lot of the elders I used to go around and see, how are you guys doing, you know? And I was like, oh, you know, and you sit and talk, things come out, and it's like, oh, can I help you with that? You know, it was like a few of the elders around had bills that were piling up. Some of them had car payments to make. Some of them had this. And, well, let me help you with that. You know, and I told them, no, don't worry about that. You know, don't worry about getting whatever back to me. So it's money that I didn't earn, you know. So I wasn't worried about getting paid back to it. Well, I guess in a way you could say, yeah, I earned it. But,
yeah.
It was something that was given, and I can't say I didn't value it, but I was able to spend it in a good way and help a lot of people. And of course, you know, when you got the cash right away, we need a vehicle, we need the house needs new furniture, you know, and my children want to do this, my children want to do that. A lot of it I spent on them, you know, and it helped me out a lot. But it also helped me to help other people. You know, and the way I seen it, this cash, it was gotten in a tough way, but I could use it to, you know. And we were doing a lot of things. I was going to a lot of healing programs and ceremonies and stuff like that. And it helped me to open my eyes. So actually, you know, kind of being a father with my... And a lot of the elders, it made me feel good, because a lot of the elders weren't afraid out here to come and ask me, hey, Randy, can you help me with this? Can you help me with that? Or one of the old Kokums would pull up, you know, I got a problem with my car. I was like, oh, go inside, have tea with Brenda, you know, I'll work, fix their car or whatever, change a tire, whatever, eh, you know, those simple things, you know, not having to work like really hard to, because it didn't have to. Like, I would work part-time for the band at that time. I was able to do like little repair jobs here and there because I was a carpenter at that time. Take what I could whenever I wanted. It was a freedom, eh? You know, that it gave me a freedom there. Yeah. But at that, it was one of those.
So let's talk about the routine at Gordon's. What time did you get up? What time did you get up? What time did you get up?
A lot of times, we were all got up about 6 o'clock, 5:30, 6 o'clock, depending on. But we had to be down to the playroom by about 7:30. Because usually we had breakfast at 8. And then from the breakfast, and the breakfasts were usually pretty good. One thing that they did have was they had good food there. You know, and it wasn't anything just slapped together. It was good quality food, nutritious. And you had a choice. Eh? You know, you could have the bacon and eggs or ham and eggs or a bowl of cereal. You know, it's like one, whatever it is you felt like eating that morning, you kind of had a choice. For the most part, there was a lot of good people there, but there was also a number that were, and the cooks were usually the ladies that were really, really good with the kids. You want a little bit more, you know, it's like, and, you know, there was a lot of activities, but along with those activities, it were kind of seemed to me to be like a cover-up for what was really going on behind the fact. And then usually by about 9 o'clock, we're all out of the end, heading, walking over to the school. And it wasn't like they lined us up and marched us out. Once you're ready to go, you could head over to the school. As long as you were in the school, the day school, by 9 o'clock. So, and then the teachers, we went through our day till about 3:30. At lunchtime, we were all back in the main residence. Because the way it was they had the residential school building. The boys' side was on the south side of the building, and the girls' side was on the north side of the building. Well, where the building ended, there was kind of like a driveway, and then the school, the day school was there with the gymnasium. So, and then, you know, it wasn't very far, like maybe from here to the band office. It was kind of across a little driveway. The way the old Librette school is, between where the gym is and the Whitecap, the Whitecap hockey arena. Sure. Like a little alleyway like that, mm-hmm. You know, it's like an access way for trucks to get around, make deliveries or whatever in the back of the, yeah. So we'd walk across. By 3:30, the school day was done. We had a little bit of free time after school till about maybe 4 or 5, in which case either you were outside in the playgrounds or you were inside maybe watching television. A lot of that time people would be a lot of there. You had the group of boys that like to stay in and watch Batman or Get Smart or whatever was on TV, you know, something that made you laugh and whatever. And then you had the group that was outside, because at that time they'd had motorcycles and go-karts at the and the kids could go out and ride, and plus they had a playground in the back there, whoever was you know. And you had to be a senior boy at that time. 12 years old was a senior, so I was a senior boy. I was 13, so I was a senior boy, and my little brother and my nephew were intermediate boys. So I'd go out and we'd be outside, and it was kind of this situation where the three of us kind of stuck together, because my little brother, and he was just a skinny little kid, and he was always getting picked on by the older boys. That was you know. And then
did you have chores?
Yeah, chores are usually done in the morning. We're done in the morning before we headed down for breakfast. And one group would clean the playroom, one would do the stairwells, one would do the hallways, and then we all did our own dorm rooms. Okay. And in Gordon's,
janitorial.
And in Gordon's, they had the dorm rooms were a pretty good size. There was Anywhere from 6 to 8, well, 3 to 4 bunk beds in a room. So, but it wasn't crowded, by no means wasn't crowded. The rooms were a good size and the bunk beds were spaced out. And then it was we would do our chores and we'd head down for breakfast. And then in the evenings, there was just a quick clean up before bed, and then shower time. Everybody got in the showers and whatnot. Senior boys all had their senior boys was on the main level. Junior boys was on the second level, and then intermediate boys was on second level, and junior boys were up on the third. Well, with the senior boys being on, because they had more senior boys than any of the other boys, they had there was a hallway that ran the length of the building, but there was a door separating the boys' side from the girls' side. Well, in that hallway there was three rooms, three big dorm rooms, and on the second floor, and that's where the overflow, like the extra boys, that the extra senior boys were, and that was up on one of those second floors. So, and then the junior boys had the main part of the dorm facilities when you stepped up into the main wing of the dorm facilities. That was generally about the part of the day. After supper, we had a little bit more free time. Supper was usually about 5, 5:30-ish. We'd all come in, line up, we'd get in our groups, senior boys, intermediate boys, junior boys. And then they'd come and do a count, make sure everybody's there, kind of when I thought about it in the later years, when I wound up in the correctional system, that counting is like, geez, this really reminds me of residential school.
Doesn't it?
But then the residential school pulling up there when I on my first day, kind of I likened it almost to pulling up to a prison or something. And it was just kind of like. And the damn hell of it was the day we went there and we got dropped off. It was a cloudy day. It was just like kind of like, oh, doom.
Were you able to go home on the weekends?
Yeah, we were able to go home on the weekends. However, there would be stretches when my mother couldn't come and get us. So we would stay there sometimes 2, 3 weekends in a row, and not be home for like a month or something, And at that point, when it got to that where you really start missing home, it's where we started running away. And this was when we ran away that one time. That's when we got caught and brought back. They brought us back. RCMP brought us back. We were sitting in the playroom, the boys' side playroom, and that's where I was sitting there, and we're laughing. This child care worker was like, "What the hell are you laughing about, eh?" I was like, "Quit laughing!" And that's when he kicked me. I was sitting there with my arms crossed like that, and he kicked me right here. When he kicked me, he kicked me so hard, there was a heel print in my forearm like this, and my forearm was broken here, the front bone, and he kicked me so hard, it went up like this. My shoulder was dislocated as well. And I was like, I went back and I came forward and I fell on the floor. Now I was trying to get up and I couldn't get up because I couldn't lift, push myself off the floor. Broken forearm and dislocated shoulder. And he's like, "Quit faking, eh?" And I was like, and I got kicked in the ribs for a day, It's like, I wound up having a couple of cracked ribs too from that incident. So I got sent to the hospital. Ambulance come, and there was records of ambulance attendance, and then at the hospital there was doctor's reports. And I remember the old guy was like, "You tell them he fell." I was like, "Okay, whatever, man."
Which old guy?
It was the one of the one of the, yeah the okay. child care worker. I don't want to say.
No, it works.
But anyways, so when I got there. I was sitting there, and There was a nurse there and the doctor, and I was telling him, yeah. He said, you got a broken forearm, because my forearm was swelled right up, and the doctor looked and was like, that looks like a heel print. Like it was kicked hard enough that it left a heel shaped bruise on. And back then the guys used to wear the shoes, the Oxford shoes with the heavy heel, usually covered with a big slab of rubber or something, right. You know, had the wooden heel with a big slab of rubber. And that left an impression in my forearm like that. Yeah. And I was like, no, I fell. He said, that looks like a heel print. You know, I was like, yeah, it might look like a heel, but I just fell. But I don't know if you have ever been to any of the old residential schools, but in the playrooms, they used to have a big cement, like kind of, I guess it would be like a seating. You know, it was like, it was usually about 3 feet like that out and about maybe 2.5 feet high. Like that, all around the edge of the wall, and the boys would just sit there and talk or whatever. Sometimes they'd be sitting there playing cards or doing whatever, you know, activity they were. Yeah. And then a lot of times the other little boys would be running around in the playroom, you know, because you had all three of the groups of boys in the playroom at the same time. But for us seniors, they also had a little, they had a billiards room right in the room next. They had two snooker tables and one smaller nine ball, whatever, you know, table. So the guys could go sit around in there, have a Coke and wait for their turn to play some snooker or whatever, you know, eight ball, whatever there. And then usually in order to maximize the tables, guys would play four at a time, you know. Either teams of two or four individual playing for themselves. And it was a lot of those times were, you know, where you're actually at a little bit of peace and enjoying yourself. To me, kind of seemed like there were far and few in between in that place, you know, where a person actually had a little bit of peace, had a little bit of for somebody to say, oh, it wasn't like that, you know, I'd have to say to those people, they were one of two things. They were either in denial of what was going on in the place, or they were one of the perpetrators of a lot of the stuff, because a lot of it went on between the students too, eh? You know, there were students that didn't like each other, so there was a lot of fights. There was students that were just plain bullies, you know, and there was those students that were being pushed around by everybody, you know. It's like, so that's the way, that's my take on that, you know. I can't say that that's the way it was, but that's the way I seen it, sure. You know.
Sure. So what made you, why did you have to change schools from Gordon's?
We got kicked out of Gordon's for running away. Run away about two or three times at that point, kicked out. But he obviously doesn't want to be here. It was like, yeah, man, I want to be here. And all of a sudden we get the, mom was like, well, I'm going to send you to Lawrence. It was like, oh, shit, place.
If I can ask, what did your mom say about your broken arm when she saw it?
Well, she didn't get all the story. She didn't get the story was, that was the thing with stuff like that. There was nothing, that kind of stuff was just not related. Oh, he had an accident, you know, and probably somewhere down the line, the story was changed, you know, from what was relayed to my mother to what actually happened, you know. And I would have to say that that was probably a case with a lot of these young people, you know, because they don't, the school administration doesn't know, oh, your child was sexually abused here, you know, or your child was beaten up or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It was an accident.
That's right.
You know.
And they have a control over it. Yeah. Basically.
Yeah.
Like, well, I guess that's a terminology these days.
Yeah.
They can say what they wanted to say.
That's right, yeah. You know, and
what, have to believe it. Kind of thing.
That's right, yeah. And for the most part, when a child, well, I can't say that because I don't know if anybody's ever told their parents, you know. If a child, it would have been a case of, oh, no, don't lie like that or something, you know, or whatever, you know. It's like, But yeah, I never. It wasn't until like maybe about 10 years ago I told my mom about. Yeah, I went to. It was a violence thing, and I told her of this old guy, and she was like, "That damn bugger. That bugger was related to your father." Yeah, I told him, "Yeah, I know." A modicum for me of retribution for that was I had other uncles that worked down there, and they were closer to my father than this other gentleman. They extracted a form of like it was like, "What'd you do to this boy? You know, that's cousin Kenneth's boy, man." It's like, and that the guy wound up. No, I didn't tell you know, when I heard about it, because I seen the old guys. The one guy was actually works for the Canadian military, and he used to run the cadets program out there, and he was an uncle of mine. And the other guy was a childcare worker, and they were both both of those guys. I knew your dad, you know, like oh, and the other guy that was the childcare worker, he used to take us hunting. So it's like, yeah, I got the old 22s here, and for you bigger boys, we got shotguns. We go rabbit hunting, eh, you know. Those were some of the, and those old guys were pretty. They took their position as uncle and caregivers to the children seriously, and they were really they were dedicated to doing things.
So, Capel Indian Residential School. First off, first day there.
Well, it wasn't such a gloomy day, but it was still pretty much the same same thing, you know, going to a place that I really don't want to be. But at that point, I kind of knew what to expect. And over there at LeBret Residential School, there was a lot of the people from our community here, you know, from all four communities, Black Bear, Star Blanket here on Oakenies, and Pipikisi. So I knew a lot more people there. Whereas in Gordon's Residential School, the people that I knew were far and few in between, because there was a lot of people there from the Northern Reserves as well as the Eastern Reserves. And, you know, so it was really, whereas over here, I knew a lot of the people. I had relatives there from Pasqua First Nation, Star Blanket, Pipikisi from here. Went to school with a lot of the Tuckanow family down there too, eh? As well as some of the Cree Lee family, a lot of Star Blanket people, and little Black Bear people. You know, as I was on, somebody sent me some pictures, screenshots from I guess somebody has a page on Facebook about the Coppell Indian Residential School, and somebody told me, "Hey Randy, isn't this you?" And there's an old school picture there, the class picture. I was like, "Holy shit, that is me." I was like, "What the hell?" And I seen a bunch of my old friends. "Oh man, I remember so and so and such and such." And a lot of, like I said, a lot of the people from around the community, as well as there was a number of people from Carrie the Kettle and Muskogee and all the Valley Reserves out that way. And a lot of them were down there. I had a few more good friends because a lot of, like I said, more of the people down there were from home here. And I was able to. I was able to make that connection with them. So,
were the routines the same, pretty much?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, you know, morning after we got up, if you wanted to shower, you showered, cleaned up your area. The dormitories down there, though, weren't so, not like Gordon's. In Gordon's, they'd had the rooms, the dorm rooms. When in LeBret, they had the great big dorm room, and however many beds were in there, and everybody slept in a kind of giant common room area. I was kind of lucky because I had a room closer to the east side of the building, right by the window. So I always had a good look at when I used to sleep in bed. If the curtains weren't drawn, I was able to look out at the skies you see this guy at night a lot of times. And there too, I was only there for maybe about 6 months. And same thing, we got kicked out too for running away. I just didn't want to be there, you know. Yeah, it was the same thing, man. It's like pretty much the same. It seemed like it was almost like, well, I can't say regimented, but it was definitely a structured, institutionalized structure to a person's day there, where you had your recreation times in the morning, this between here and there, your meal, education program, back for lunch. In Librette, the day school was down the street from the residence, and Librette, where the old church cathedral, there's that little school right beside.
Okay.
It. That's where we went to school, to the day school. So and it was a little walk, you know, whatever, a couple hundred yards down the street. So we had the kids were either had a choice. Some would walk down the back alleys behind the house, row of houses down the street, or just come right down the street. You know, it's like, they had, I believe, from grade 2 on up to grade 6 at that place. And then once you hit grade 7, you were bused to Fort Capel Elementary, or Bert Fox, whatever it was that day. But I didn't stick around down there too long. I didn't. Residential school just wasn't. I was so used to living on the reserve. You know, we used to. When my father was alive, we had our chores out here, but used to always do things like we had 22, so we were able to go hunt ducks and snare rabbits. You know, so these were things that. Being a res boy, you missed out on, you know. It was definitely something that you missed, and being tossed into this system that was completely, it was a shock to the city, you know, to a person, especially to a young boy who was coming off the reserve, living with his father, and having my own chores, my own system, and, you know, doing this and that. And I had to help look after my little brother and my nephews, because being older than them, I was 3 years older than my little brother, and my nephew was the same age. So I was kind of like help look after them when my father was out working. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about education? You feel you got a good, decent, or fair education
from those systems, The education was good. I was told at that time when I did the, I had pretty good education marks. I had good high scores in school. I wasn't failing anything, and I wasn't near failing anything. So it was kind of one of those things where you focus on what's being taught to you, so you get your mind off all the other bullshit going on in the background day of the day. The actual classroom time was kind of one of those times that was, it was a respite. But sometimes during those days, the bullshit that went on in the school would go on in the classroom too, depending on the mood of the teacher and which teacher you had, and, you know. But for the most part, a lot of the teachers are really good. But a lot of it was with the students' attitude towards each other. It kind of seemed like if they had to put up with this bullshit, well, they're going to pass it on to somebody else too, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what it seemed like to me anyways. I can't say that it was that way for everybody, because I mean, definitely there was those kids that would somebody would try and it was like, no, you're not, you know. And that's when usually a lot of the fights happened, and that's where I got into a lot of the fights myself. You're not doing that, man, you know. And that's where, prior to that, man, I learned to fight in residential school, you know. They had boxing program, they had a wrestling program, they had the military cadets program, which one of my relatives ran, and he ran that program really good, man. It was always kind of one of those things. And the boxing program, too. it was kind of like, okay, I'm going to go in here and get this frustration, this anger out, and we'd spar. And I would, a few times I got in trouble for getting a little carried away with the sparring in the boxing ring. Okay. And I was like, okay, all right, yeah, you're right. I shouldn't have did that.
Exactly.
I'll take my punishment. I did that, you know. So.
Okay. Well, I think we got a lot to cover there. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, not really. I think that's pretty much, you know, it's pretty much my experience with the residential schools. But yeah, you've seen a lot of the boys that used to had it really hard, worse than me. You know, I was a big one of the older, being 13, and at that time, like, we develop our bodies had developed, and I was starting to put on weight, and it was kind of like, but sticking up for my little brothers usually got me in trouble with other boys that were larger than myself, and that's where the fights really got. You know, it was like, I'll get you later. Well, not going anywhere. Let's do it again if we have to, you know. I guess it was kind of a problem because a lot of my one relative that was there, that was a child care worker. Randy, man, you can't be, you know. It's like, let it go, you know. Don't sit there and egg them on, you know. It's like, okay, well, let's do it again, man, you know. It's like, be bigger than that, you know. And those uncles were like, okay, uncle, but it's tough to, it's tough to push it off to the side, especially when you see these other boys picking on my little brother and my nephew, you know. It's like, they stand in there and they're older brothers, and, you know, and not being, a person. I'm not backing down to you, you know. It's like, the only way to stop your bullshit is to give you that.
Continue on here. All right, so you mentioned before how your dad attended the residential school, he found those residential school.
Yeah.
What can you remember of him telling you any stories about that school?
I haven't heard. There was something that my father never spoke of. My mother rarely spoke of Lebret Residential too, but there was some stuff that she spoke of. But I never, you know, if anything that I've heard about the school here were from uncles, like mm-hmm. my late uncles, Uncle John, Uncle Chappie, Uncle Lionel, different. But I never heard anything from my father. You know, it's something that I imagine he put out of his mind and never.
Sure, definitely.
Know, I'll not speak of this anymore. You know, it's like, it was mostly family, and then aunties as well mm-hmm. too. You know, I've heard.
So, do you remember some of those things that they would you would overhear them talking about?
Well, any of the with those, and it wasn't overhearing them. It was kind of like them telling us, "Yeah, this child went missing, that child, and they never seen them again." You know, Uncle John used to tell us about the kids that drowned in the lake up there. You know, it was like, it was winter time, and he was sliding in an accident, going through the ice, and I was like, it's not a very big lake. How come they did not find these? You know. That was my questions, but with the old elders, they were like, it was something. And you could tell when I'd turned 55 and I would sit in with the elders next door here and listen to their stories, you could hear in their voice, you know, you could hear the hurt. You could hear the, in some cases, the anger. You could hear, you know, it was like, and it was something that, from what they spoke of about the different buildings and the conditions and the punishments and just the different things that went on, you know, it's like, it was kind of one of those things where you want to, well, for the most part, I went and I shook hands with these elders, the elderly Kokums, I give them a hug, tell them, you know, and they was like, that was a day ago and an age away, you know, and they tell me about this. I've done my best to get past this, you know, and I can't believe that there was another generation beyond me that went through this as well. You'd think that with, and that was something that I heard from a couple of the elders, you know, after them being through what they were through, they were surprised that there was also a generation after them that went through the same thing. Whereas when it was them, it should have been stopped right there. But it happened again because, and the old elder told us it was because we didn't learn from what happened before, and that mistake happened again.
Recall any stories recalling about the cemetery?
The cemetery I've known was there for a long time. I haven't heard any stories, but from what I understand, when they did the ground penetrating radar search, that there's more graves out there than was actually marked. But as for that cemetery, being a kid out here on the reserves, I'd known about that place. They used to tell us, the old people used to tell us, stay away from that area. There's people resting in that bush, you know, in the different areas. So we're told, yeah. And as a kid, we're like, yeah, okay. You know, you listen. It was something that you didn't go out there to just go and look around. Oh, where is the cemetery? You know, it's like the sleeping are at rest. They're to be left alone until they come to see you, in which case you honor them with tobacco if they're asking for tobacco, or you put down food when they're asking for food. This was a place that I didn't, and I know a lot of the other boys, because we were taught to be respectful of those that are resting, you know, those that are in there doing the sleep, you know, so we had enough sense to knock, but we knew where the place was.
How would you like to see, or what kind of form would you like to see it as remembering and honoring the students at the Foothill School? And how do you think that would help survivors and their families?
Well, the remembering of it, the memorial plaques and stuff like that, maybe a monument would be fine. A place to go and recollect and remember, you know, and honor. The survivors, helping them to recognize. Shit, man, right now in this day and age, I'm a grandfather, and I have grandchildren, my sister's grandchildren, that have children. So in essence, I'm a great-grandfather, as a chapon, great-grandparent, eh? You know, I see that it is happening with them. They're still suffering it, you know. This is a multi-generational thing that's still going on. I got grandchildren that are living with addictions, and their children are already paying that price. My daughter that I raised, who is my granddaughter, is looking after her little sister's children, you know. This effect is, it's so deep-seated in our people, you know, and it's tough that the thing that our people need is that help to recognize, because a lot of our people are still in denial over this, and it's affected, whether it's through addictions or not being able to educate themselves, or just being an emotionally damaged person. You know, that help needs to be there. I would like to see more programming. I mean, we got our thing like our day walker home fire, but more has got to be done than that. The reach out to help those people to heal. The healing is the thing. That healing, man, it's like. And my daughter, she just worked with me. She was working at the casino with me. She had to take a leave of absence to go help her little sister with her children, because this girl is this young lady is dealing with alcohol addiction and substance abuse addictions. So, and there she's on the verge of where she's going to be losing her children to that social services. So my daughter and the girl's the girl's stepfather, adopted father, are looking after the child. And my daughter right now had to leave, and she was getting a good, she was in a good paying position at the casino with me. I was the one that got her in there. So, you know, it was like that help. It needs to cover those generations. That would be the, to me, that would be the format of honoring and helping, and to help our people get past this. You know, this was a big damage to our people, and it's still going on, generations after. Man, if I count this correct, that's like my parents, me, my children, grandchildren, great grandchildren. That's six generations, you know. And my sister was a, my daughter, who is my sister's granddaughter that I raised, she was in residential school at Breckbridge, and she attended a lot longer than myself. Several of my older siblings attended Lebret residential school, and you know, it is our parents that affected her, her children, her grandchildren, and now her great-grandchild. You know, that's too many generations. That's the intergenerational impact. Just, we got to stop. It's got to be stopped someplace. You know, I myself have taken it upon myself to try to get myself well. But there's a lot of people out there that can't get past that, you know. And it's those ones that we really have to worry about. You can tell them, and you can tell them, and you can tell them, but it's still got to be, it's the, even people give up and say, oh, if they don't want to be helped, they don't want to. No, we still got to keep trying to drive that. Drive it home. You need help. You need help. You know, it's like, these kind of, you know, and I'm at a loss for it. I speak with my children, and I speak with my nieces and nephews and my grandchildren now that I have. My oldest grandchild is 15 years old. Atia just turned 15 years old. These little people are just like, when I used to hear the elders say, your children, you love your children. When these little grandchildren come up, they're something else, you know. And they'll boss you around, and you'll do as much as you can. And it's I found that out, man. It's like 15 years being bossed around by that little lady and her brothers, and now three other little ones. It's something that I take that seriously. And with my nieces and nephews, they told, I've heard that out of them. No, hey, go talk to uncle. We talk to uncle, but if uncle doesn't like it, he'll let you know. Because I've always taken that that position that I'm an uncle, and this is, because I had uncles that, no boy, you can't do that. You know, they took that they took that duty of being an uncle seriously, and that's where I picked that up, you know, and tried to talk to our young people, because they're the ones that really, if you can help that next one, that next one's that little much better, then the next one will be a little bit more well, and so on and so forth. I like to think that I've did a good job with my children and the children that I've helped to raise. Because most of them finished school, most of them are good, hardworking young people, and I tried to, you know, it was like when I was young here, when I had my residential money, I bought these vehicles and I bought canoes, and I always had a vehicle full of young, my kids and all their little buddies, and I was like, I got them. And nieces and nephews, and I'd have a truck full of kids, and I'd take them down to, okay. Don't put these canoes into the water. I got to go get a couple more of this. And I was always doing stuff with them, you know. To me, that was a big reward, you know. I got to spend so much time with my nieces and nephews and do things with them. It was so nice, yeah.
Okay, all right, you're done. That's pretty much good.